on March 31st, 1990, by Edwin Bronner. I started to say that nowadays we get a certain amount of protest about signing the examinations as part of the honor code.
Oh, yes.
At the end of my exam in last beginning of this month, one of the Quaker students, as he turned in the exam, began to start arguing with me about having to sign the honor promise. And I did suggest that wasn't really the right place to carry on the discussion. I was trying to get all the papers in so the next class could get in the room. But this has happened periodically, and there is that sense they can no longer have to challenge fifth day meeting, but they can now challenge the honor code on this kind of a basis. Did you get much talk in your day about, well, this is un-Quakerly? Nowadays, if students don't want to do something, well, they decide it's un-Quakerly and talk about it in those terms. Did you get that sort of thing?
Not that I recall, no. It was more that they felt that what was being done was Quakerly and they didn't approve of it. But my deep conviction was that sharing in worship, sharing in the weekly collection, participating in the honor system as strongly as they did in those days were all parts of the educational process. Mm-hmm. And that if students didn't want that kind of educational process, there are plenty of other places where they could go.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that collections were relatively popular with students, or was there very much resistance to collection?
Initially, there was protest about collection. I set up a student collection committee and put it in the hands of the students to decide who they wanted to hear. And that meant that the protests were directed at the students rather than at me. I would support whatever decisions they made, and sometimes we would have lengthy arguments about who was a suitable candidate or not. In the McCarthy days, for example, great argument about having speakers that were pro-communist and anti-communist. Mm-hmm. I felt we should have both sides. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was very earnest debate about having Senator McCarthy come. And I invited him. He didn't come, as it turned out. But I felt that students ought to be exposed to that rascal as he was, if they wanted to. Mm-hmm.
Was there any thought at that time of inviting Richard Nixon?
No, not at that time. When did Nixon enter the Congress?
In 47, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was January of 47.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about him from Clarence Pickett at that time. Mm-hmm. Nixon's mother had been very much concerned about
yes,
him.
Yes.
No, Nixon didn't come in. I don't remember any conscious decision not to ask him, but
yes.
he just wasn't one that was. Mm-hmm.
I remember having lunch with him in Washington in the spring of 47 when I went with Grant Mead's group of political science students down to interview various and sundry people in Washington, and we did sit next to each other at lunch and chatted, and I must say at that point he sounded much more moderate and reasonable than he sounded later on, because I'd known him as a kid in California.
Oh, had you?
Yeah.
Whittier?
Yeah. We were born in the same town.
Did you know his mother?
No, I never really did know his mother. I remember having Sunday dinner with the Nixons when my father had been the speaker, the preacher at East Whittier meeting, but I don't remember the family particularly on that occasion. Of course, Olive Marshburn, I've known his her sister.
Yes.
I've known very well over the years, and Oscar's still living. Last I
is he?
Yes. We now have very elaborate structures for adding and dismissing faculty members. Did these changes come in your time, or did they come later?
Well, in my time, we had we set up search committees, and we had a group representative of the faculty with whom I consulted on any kind of important issues, and then there were the two faculty who were elected to the Board of Managers, you may recall that, which seemed a good scheme to have them present. So that, excuse me. I thought it was important to always have the faculty represented independently at a Board of Managers meeting.
Yes.
So that they could speak for the faculty if necessary, and so they could report back, and that there wouldn't be any question about what stand I had taken.
Had and that been I'll, done before you came, or did you
I don't
start
think
that?
So. And I always consulted with them about anything that was going to come to the Board of Managers, and then there was a larger group of faculty with whom I talked. And then for any new appointment, there was search committee. In a number of instances, in the time I was here, I went out very actively looking for faculty when we had a vacancy. That is, I didn't just wait for people to apply or for the word to come through the faculty itself. I went and talked with people. That's the way I got Wayne Booth, for example. I went to the University of Chicago and asked them who would be candidates for our new English program. And they gave me their list of candidates. And then I went to one of the faculty members and asked who was the best teacher in the department. Well, they said Wayne Booth. And I said, well, why wasn't he on your list of possible candidates for Haverford? And he said, well, Wayne wouldn't leave Chicago.
Wayne what?
He wouldn't leave Chicago. And so I promptly went to see Wayne, and he did decide to leave Chicago and come to us. And I remember going to Harvard and scrounging around the Litauer School and finding Red Summers. I had a delightful conversation with Red, I remember, because he thought I was a junior faculty member. He didn't know what my position was at Haverford. I just said I was from Haverford. And we talked about colleges and how you ought to handle fellow faculty members and students and administration and so on. And afterwards, I went back and then arranged for Red to come. He was surprised to find what my position was. But I did a great deal of that. And so I would, just as the young man from Oxford, I tried to canvass people, and then I would bring them up for review along with other candidates. The only person I ever appointed without doing that was Ariel Lowy.
Was?
Ariel Lowy, because I ran into him in Switzerland one summer, and we needed him for the fall, and I appointed him with the understanding it would be just for a year, and then he would take a chance as to whether the faculty would approve of him afterwards. And I asked the faculty to bear with me in getting on to a very good person for whom it was impossible to follow the usual procedures during the summer. I don't think otherwise I ever made an appointment without going through that process. Now, I do know some faculty felt the process was being manipulated. And it was, in a sense, that I was concerned about finding the right people, and I went around and did more than being in a passive position of waiting for applicants to come in. So I think that, but now to the structures we had in place at that time has been added the whole affirmative action process. And much more formality with respect to dismissing faculty. But we did dismiss faculty, and we did it by laborious and I think somewhat sensitive consultation with people. I don't think we ever just called in somebody and said that they were fired for the next year, but we would. I spent a lot of time talking with people, trying to show them that it was to their advantage as well as the college's.
Did you follow a practice of early retirement with some financial advantages to them?
No, we didn't. No. Not at that time.
How long was Ariel here with Dixie Dunn? And I've forgotten the other man's name.
He was
doing. I've got the name down here. Howard Henry, I guess.
Yes, Howard Henry. Yes, who was approaching retirement. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten what the overlap was.
But Ariel, before long, was given freedom to really completely change the department.
Yes.
You really did find it was important to make a lot of faculty changes in this period, didn't you? Bill Lunt, for example, retired in this time.
Yes. I wasn't anxious to see him go.
But
I was not anxious to see him go, but I was anxious that he be replaced by a person of equal quality.
And yet Lunt, great as he was, look back to an earlier period. I realized, much as I admired him and really liked him personally, that his approach to history was not the approach at the Penn Graduate School where I was doing graduate work at that time.
And you may remember we got Rex Aragon to come as a visitor, who stood for quite a different approach to history.
Yes.
It seemed to me that it was important to let the faculty be exposed to this point of view without trying to make an abrupt transition from Lunt to something.
And then
else.
Wallace came after.
Yes.
Did Wallace come just before you retired?
No, some time before I was. And I thought Wallace's appointment was just the kind of ideal appointment I would like to make. That is, that he did great work for Haverford, and then he went on to Harvard. But it was necessary, in order to make that transition, to bring Aragon in, to demonstrate what the viable, important alternative was.
We've talked earlier about your fundraising activity. Did you have to go after the Ford Foundation grant or grants, or did they come without solicitation?
Well, I don't.
Or was there some of each?
I don't know of any grants that we didn't go after.
Well, I had the feeling that the Ford Foundation was giving a lot of money to a lot of colleges at this particular juncture. Am I incorrect about that?
Ford was not a major factor with us at that time. We were getting money from alumni, and we had very substantial grants from Carnegie, some of which worked out well and some didn't. Well, I think in every case, some of us had to go and present our needs, and it was important, as far as I was concerned, to be able to be confident that faculty were solidly behind a proposal and were going to work to their best to achieve it.
Were you able to double the endowment during your years? You spoke earlier of hoping to double the endowment.
Yes, I think so. We could look up the figures on that, but as I recall, the endowment was somewhere around $4.5 million. When I left, it was somewhere around $11 million. Mm-hmm. But perhaps more important than doubling the endowment was the grants for special purposes, because
yes,
in effect they added greatly to the annual income. And by reducing the number of students, one reduced the tuition income, but we had calculated with Aldo Caselli that the students were costing us money rather than bringing us in money at that stage, and given the competitive tuition situation. Mm-hmm. By increasing endowment and decreasing student tuition, we were enhancing the amount of money that was available for each student.
How did you get along with the Board of Managers those years? See, now Morris Leeds was still there when you...
Yes, and then Emlyn Stokes.
And then Emlyn Stokes.
Yes.
Was the Board of Managers quite responsive, or were there foot draggers, or... you don't have to name names if you don't want to, but...
I have no serious complaints about the Board of Managers. Mm-hmm. I felt the Board of Managers was...
I'm going to move this a little closer. I think maybe your voice is from the cold is beginning to fade just a little bit.
I had no complaints about the Board of Managers. Mm-hmm. It included some very conservative people, some very liberal people. It always, in my experience, was open to any ideas that came from the college. It was deliberate. I never felt that it had failed to back me on any proposal that I made that I thought was sound. But in many instances, I would work out with some key members of the Board of Managers the proposal to make sure that I understood all the sorts of objections that might be likely to come, and that we therefore could confront them before rather than after they came onto the table. Emlyn Stokes was excellent to work with. And J. Henry Scattergood on the financial side. Mm-hmm. Harold Evans as counsel, mm-hmm, always prudent and cautious, and basically very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Jonathan influential by that time? Or?
Jonathan Rose was quite influential. He obviously was one of the more respected members of the board. Mm-hmm. His voice counted for a great deal. But I don't recall serious disputes in the board.
Well, they'd gone through some times, I gather, with Felix Morley, and perhaps they were glad to settle into a new phase.
Yeah. Well, maybe I benefited from that. I know there were some members of the board that were less enthusiastic about me and my policies than others, but considering the fact that they'd taken really a very long risk at appointing me, that I think became an advantage. They realized that they had gone off the deep end in appointing a person with my experience and age, and they therefore had a certain obligation to try to help me succeed. Mm-hmm. I think of people like Stanley Yarnell, Jack Gummery, Wilmot Jones. I go down the list. They were consistently helpful.
Is it true that you were mistaken on the campus for a freshman, a Riney, at least once?
A number of times, yes.
A number of times. Mm-hmm. Did upperclassmen ever try to make you do something as a Riney?
No. No, I think that is false myth that has been developed. I remember just when college was opening, Ann and I were coming up the avenue from the Pike in our car, which was a little Ford touring car. And as we went through the gate, there were a couple of students walking, and we stopped and said, "Do you want a ride?" So they hopped in. And we said, "Where are you going?" They said they were going to Berkeley. So we drove up and let them off at Berkeley. And they said, "Where are you living?" And I said, "We're at number one College Circle." "Oh," they said, "the president's house." "Well, that's nice." And we drove off. Then 2 days later in collection, I remember seeing them up in the balcony sitting up there. The surprise on their faces when I walked out on the stage. But and there were some students like that. It's a false rumor that they ever threatened to throw me in the pond.
I suspected that, but the college thrives on folklore.
Oh, yes, it's an interesting kind of story.
I think the impression people have is that your great contribution to Haverford was in upgrading the curriculum and the faculty, and that the money sort of came in, but you've suggested this morning that you really put an awful lot of effort into the fundraising side of the college in that period. Is that fair?
That's correct. And it was made possible chiefly by Lester Hayworth.
Yes.
And the people that he assembled. I think Lester is one of the Haverford family who is least appreciated. He deserves more credit than anybody else for the improved funding situation of the college.
And we really, after Lester was gone, we had a long time when we really didn't make it the way that that we ought to have been.
Yes, the college, with the reputation it had then, should have been much more vigorous than it was, which is too bad. But Lester was the key to it. When we left Haverford and went to Chicago, the most important change in our family life was that I had summers free for scholarly work and scientific activity, and which I hadn't had at Haverford because I used the summers in very large measure for fundraising. Mm-hmm. Like the Billy Phillips expeditions,
yes.
Going around, seeing various people, visiting folks, wherever. Mm-hmm. Lester was indefatigable in suggesting things that I could do in that direction. There were so many people who'd been out of the Haverford family financially for a long time, mm-hmm. and they needed cultivation. They
yeah.
needed just to be told what was happening at the college.
Was Howard Marshall approached in that period?
Yes. Oh, we worked hard on Howard Marshall. Didn't see much results.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked hard on Mr. Marsh down in Texas. Never got a dollar from him, so far as I know. Well, there were lots of people we worked on.
What about Jimmy McGill?
Yes, we worked on Jimmy McGill. We didn't get much money from him mm-hmm. at that time, but he's an example of the kind of person who I think was cultivated then and gradually took on a much different
yes.
role in the life of the college. And those things come slowly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I remember in the late 40s and even early 50s, there were so many people that were just surprised to see President of Haverford coming to see them or joining in something with them because they hadn't been accustomed to that.
Yes.
And they were suspicious of me anyway.